Well, thank you very much. As usual with these introductions, you hope that you can live up to them, because I don't think I'm close to the things that Lyle said. It's truly an honor to be here. I deeply appreciate the invitation, and I feel an enormous responsibility being the person to give the first talk at this wonderful conference. So I wasn't going to have a handout. I was just going to try to talk, but I woke up feeling sort of sick at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I don't know if I can just give a talk by talking. I think maybe I better make a PowerPoint. So there's not very much on this PowerPoint. It's mostly words, maybe just a little bit more words than are on the handout. But one of the reasons I wanted to have the handout is because it's not just my name that's on this. It's a number of names. And I'm going to talk for a while, and then I'll introduce all of the people that are included on this. And if you look on the handout, it actually tells what the affiliations of the various people are. So what I want to do today in looking at this topic, language documentation and conservation strategies for moving forward, is think about first how we can evaluate moving forward. I feel like I can't see people here. I'm not tall enough. So I thought that in order to think about what it means to move forward, it would be helpful to start off by thinking about where we've come from in recent years, because if we look back a little bit, maybe we can evaluate what moving forward means. And we've heard a little bit about looking back in the introductory remarks, so we know where this conference came from and where the journal came from and everything. So I thought that what I would do is start off by looking back over the past 10 or 15 years, so looking primarily at documentation and conservation, how these concepts were understood as they came to be introduced, and just give kind of my overall quick impressions. I think people will agree or disagree with me about details, but to give some idea of where we've come from. And then after we do that, what we'll do is we'll look at two particular projects that I've been really fortunate to be involved with over recent years. One, a very small project in Toronto, and the other, a much more complex and longer-term project in a community in the Northwest Territories. So that's sort of overall what we're going to do. Okay, so that's what it says there. Like I said, I made this at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I don't know if it's totally in my head. So I think that if we think about the decade of the 90s, there was lots going on in that time period that played a big role in bringing us here to a conference like this today. So first there was Himmelmann's very important article. It first was the work on language endangerment. I guess I should start there. Then was Himmelmann's very important article on language documentation, setting out that field. Then there was the development or recognition, maybe naming of what's come to be called variously language conservation, revitalization, maintenance, sustainability. There are a lot of names. The name that we're using in the title here is conservation. And finally, something that I think was mentioned in one of the introductory remarks, participatory research models. Those are known by a number of other names as well, and we'll come to those. So what we'll do is look just really briefly at each of these. So language endangerment. I think I first heard Ken Hale talk about the notion of language endangerment in the 1990s. I think any of us that had been involved in doing field work in a number of communities had recognized well before that that things were really changing with languages. But as with many things, sometimes it takes putting a name to it to realize that it's time to begin to do something about it. And I think the 1990s was the time when we really began to recognize this. So there was a book edited by Robbins and Uhlenbeck, published in 1991, on language endangerment. There was the 1991 Linguistic Society of America Symposium that was organized by Ken Hale and Michael Krauss and Colette Grunewald and others that was published in 1992, and so on. We could enumerate things. When we look at the early work that was done on language endangerment, we find a number of reasons given for why it's important to have languages. And they tend to focus on things like the maintenance of linguistic diversity and that the loss of language is a tremendous loss to our cultures and knowledge systems. At the same time, these early articles really tend to focus on the linguistic profession, and there was some pushback on those. And the only article I'll mention, although there's much more than this, is the work by Jane Hill, where she says that the early work on language endangerment could actually be viewed as very self-serving. She steps right back from that position and she says she doesn't think the people involved in this really are just trying to serve the needs of the profession, but it could be viewed in that way as serving the needs of the profession and not being about the people who spoke the languages. But she goes on to talk about what she calls hyperbolic valorization of languages, or treating of languages as priceless treasures, about the notion of universal ownership. What does it mean to have universal ownership of languages? And about problems of focusing on numbers. But I think that what we have to say is whatever the strength or weaknesses in the discourse around language endangerment is something that's kind of captured the public imagination today and has allowed for gatherings like this to happen. Okay. Let's move on to language documentation. Nicholas Himmelmann published a very influential article in 1998 where he defined the notion of language documentation as distinct from, and there's debates about this, but as distinct from a notion of language description. So what is documentation? Himmelmann talks about it as a collection of primary data, the linguistic practices and traditions of a speech community, and he treats it as separate from analysis. Most of the time I'm giving quotes here, I hope I'm signaling them the way I talk rather than doing this. Okay. He talks about the results of documentation. So this is a corpus of utterances with notes on observation and comments by speaker and compiler on particular forms or constructions. It's a corpus of natural events, observed events, staged events, elicitation, and this can include things as various as exclamations, directives, conversations, monologues, ritual speech. Those of you who have read Himmelmann, I'm not adding anything to this. This is what's in there. He talks about procedures for documentation, so participant observation, elicitation, recording, transcription, translation of primary data. He talks about methodological issues like sampling, reliability, and naturalness, and he says that the work should be informed by linguistic typology, descriptive linguistics, field methods, ethnography of communication, and variationist work. He talks about the value of documentation. Collections of primary data have at least the potential of being of use to larger groups of interested parties, including the speech community itself, which might be interested in a record of its practices. He talks a little bit about the role of speakers in documentation. And the basic thing he says in that article is that all contributors will have a say in what can be done and what cannot be done with their contributions. In some communities, this might not be possible, but basically what he's talking about there is rights to privacy and the preference that he saw contributors as having for clean or edited data. So that's the bulk of the article. It's really about the work that the linguists are doing. But there's a paragraph at the end where he talks about further issues, and he says, one further topic pertains to the question of how communities can be actively involved in the design of a concrete documentation project from the very beginning. In some communities, he goes on to say, there may be strong ideas about how documentation should proceed, which do not necessarily overlap with the researchers' plans. How can and should such conflicts be resolved? how can a documentation project be presented to a community in such a way that the community is likely not only to accept it, but also to shape it in essential aspects? So he's really kind of looking at this as things coming from the outside, and how is the researcher going to get the community to kind of go along with what it is that the researcher wants to do. Now, he wouldn't write that way today, so I'm quoting a 1998 article, not a current work by Himmelmann. The field of documentation as developed in that article has been tremendously influential. And I'll just name a very few of the things that have come out of it. So there's DOBES that was set up. There's the, I forget what is it called now, Peter? Not called Hans Rausing anymore, Endangered Language Program, the Documenting Endangered Language Program out of NSF. And all of these are really designed to focus on research on endangered languages. There's been amazing advances in technology that have been useful to just about everybody that's involved. I won't go through all the kinds because I think people are familiar with those. There's been a focus on archives, and the archives, if you take a look at the ones at the Hans Rausing Fund, that's probably the most recent one, but lots of other places where there's wonderful archives set up. There's been a lot of work on best practice with respect to language. And there's been a lot of other things that have happened. So there's the journal from here. There's the book that's becoming a journal from the Hans Rausing program, the Language Documentation and Description. Maybe kind of tangentially, when we're talking about documentation, more talking about a deeper notion of description, there's also been awards developed by the Association for Linguistic Typology for outstanding grammars. So there's been just huge amounts of activity that have gone on in this field of documentation. And I think most of us are here in this room because of this field of documentation developing. What about documentation and the community? So we saw this thing that Himmelmann said about communities, but how has that unfolded? So I just want to make a transition here then to talking about conservation. So how has that unfolded? Well, we've got to think about how documentation, how it might relate to the community, because the community is really who it's all about. It's the community's languages. It's not the linguists who are saying, we need to save your language. It's the communities who are saying, we want our languages. So we want to look at a transition to that. This, I think, is from the final version of Tony Woodbury's paper that's to appear in a volume on language endangerment. He says, within the wider realm of language activism, language planning, and language revitalization and maintenance, documentation, written or otherwise, need not play a central role or even any role at all. Okay, so what's the role of documentation? Okay, so now let's turn to conservation. So as I said, there's a variety of terms: language conservation, revitalization, sustainability, maintenance. So this is really what we might look at, is the human aspect of the documentation and the language endangerment. There's been wonderful work on this, and some of the people are here. Leanne Hinton and Ken Hale have an extremely influential book on language revitalization that I think has been a guide to all of us that have been involved in this. Lenore Grenoble and Lindsay Whaley's book is a very important one, the book called Saving Languages, published in 2006. So there's been a lot here, and I'm not going to say a lot more here because this is really what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. And there have also been critiques about language endangerment, people like Mufwene and Heller looking at economic value of language and that languages don't play any role in an economy, so why bother? What we're going to do now, though, it's because we're coming back to conservation, is go on and look at the notion of language activism. As I said, this has other names as well. These are all sort of different, but I've grouped them all together. So language activism, participatory research models, community-based research, collaborative research models. The first work that I'm aware of in this area is the work that was done by David Wilkins in Australia, Linguistic Research Under Aboriginal Control, an account of his field work and his engagement with communities in that work, so that the direction for the work was really coming from the communities rather than coming from the linguists, and kind of the transformation that he went through. There's also important work by Deborah Cameron and a number of other authors who I think might be in the references on that sheet on ethics in fieldwork and the different models of fieldwork that you might have. They're looking more broadly than this particular type of fieldwork. They're coming more from a sociolinguistic perspective, but their work has been tremendously important, and most people that have written on ethics in linguistics have talked about that work. There's work done on community-based models or collaborative models by linguists, and I'll just mention my two favorite ones, and both these people are here, I think. Eva Tchaikovska-Higgins' article on her work with communities in British Columbia, and Eva and our co-author are here today and will be talking, and Raquel Yamada, who I think I saw earlier, who's talked about the work that she's done in Suriname, and I think those are my favorite articles about this. And I put out a quote from a talk that was given at the last meeting here about inclusive research or collaborative research, that it includes both the researcher and the researched, accommodating needs and expertise of all involved. Okay, that was a really quick summary, but I thought it was useful to see where we had come from to think about what it means when we say moving forward. So we've come from a time when we've had a lot of focus on the notion of language documentation. People understand that in a variety of ways, but it's basically about trying to make sure that the widest range of discourses of found in a language are recorded and available. So sort of in a nutshell, that's what it's all about. How much description does it involve? Does it involve grammars? Does it involve dictionaries? It's up to you whether you want to include that in your definition or not. A notion of language revitalization, of communities being interested in having languages spoken, is something that really wasn't talked about very much around 15 years ago, but is really a part of the title of this conference and something that's viewed as very important now. The notion of ethics in linguistics. It was very, very rare to find anything written about ethics before about 10 years ago. In recent times, there's older work on it, but in recent times it was very, very rare. And now there's a lot written on ethics in linguistics, and this is really what these models are all about. What I want to do now is look at more carefully some of the community-based models. And I want to talk just a little bit about the community-based models that we often find talked about in the literature, and then I want to talk about the models that I've been involved with. So let me say about community-based models, or any models, that there's no one-size-fits-all. There's a talk to be given here that's called something like in favor of a lone wolf model. Well, these community-based models are saying that's not the way to do it, but you've got to remember, you've got to be what works for the particular circumstances. So in certain circumstances, one thing will work. In other circumstances, another thing will work. And nothing's going to work at every single time because communities are changing entities. Linguists are changing entities, and so things are going to change over time. They're not stable, and that's one of the things that, to me, is the most exciting, and it's also the hardest thing, is that we're always changing, and it's always shifting ground. You never know where you stand. So from things I read, it seems to me that, in general, when we're looking at these kind of collaborative models, they tend to be taking language as the starting point and looking at collaboration around language. Now, clearly language is a really important goal for linguists, but what I'd like to ask is, are there other starting points that there might be, or is building these collaborative models that end up in doing a lot of work on language documentation and language revitalization, is language the necessary starting point? And what we're going to do is look at two models, very different and similar at the same time, that really have a very different starting point. So what they're doing is they're taking notions of what are the things that are really of interest in these communities at this time. What are the things that people really want to understand? They're taking notions of community development. How can we build a community and use language as one of the blocks for building that community? They're taking notions of what is the health of a community all about? Is language part of the health of a community? And if so, how does it play a role? So they're taking, and they're taking notions like history, where have we come from, and what is the role of language in where we've come from. They're taking all of those things as the starting point. So that's where they're beginning, is from those notions. With one of the programs, the first one we'll look at, language is also critically involved in it, but what underlay the interest in language was an interest in community. With the other one, what we'll see is a case where the community has been deeply engaged in a sense, and somebody had a quote like this, of trying to understand what the past has to say about the future, and language enters in critically in trying to understand the past. In both of these cases, the notion of documentation is not what's driven anything. In fact, documentation has resulted, but it's not the starting point. Okay. In both of these cases, revitalization or conservation is very important. But at least in one of the cases, I'm not sure if it would be obvious to you that that was going on if you went to visit the community. So these are what I want to talk about, these cases where there's all sorts of stuff going on about language, but the starting points aren't language necessarily. The starting points are something very different. And this isn't going to work everywhere, but I think they're interesting models to think about in terms of a notion of moving forward. What other kinds of things are there that are possible? Okay, so let me introduce everybody now. Lyle gave me one kind of introduction, and let me give a little slightly different kind of introduction. I first began doing fieldwork in some of the communities in the Northwest Territories of Canada. I'll show you a map later. In the early 1970s, I'd actually first begun working with a speaker of one of the, what I'll call Dene, that Lyle said Slavey, but Dene is the name that's used now. It's spelled D-E-N-E, languages in that area. I first began doing fieldwork in a time shortly after what was called the Berger Inquiry. So the Northwest Territories of Canada is an area that's very rich in oil and natural gas. And at that time, in the late 1960s, the federal government had wanted to build a pipeline along the Mackenzie Valley in order to get the oil and natural gas from the Mackenzie Valley south. Something very interesting happened that was called the Berger Inquiry. So what they decided was that before they could build this, they really had to consult with the communities in the Northwest Territories about whether it was a good idea to build this pipeline or not. I think this was an historical event in the country. So what happened was a judge named Thomas Berger visited all of the communities in the Northwest Territories and held hearings in those communities, everything in the native languages of the communities, And the result of that was that it wasn't the time to build the pipeline because the communities weren't yet going to be able to handle the sociological effects of the pipeline, and they weren't ready to deal with the environmental effects either. That pipeline is going to be built now. It's just been approved about a month ago, but this is quite a few, 30 years later. So it's taken 30 years for the communities to say, okay, we want this, rather than saying, we don't want to have anything to do with this. So I began doing field work in a time where there was a lot of activism in the communities that grew out of the Berger Inquiry, and at a time where in order to do field work there, you really had to be engaged in other kinds of things. I think that's partly my personality anyway. But I did a lot of work with training people and with people training me, a lot of dictionary work, a lot of working with teams of people to develop curriculum materials for the schools and so on. Since then, I've done a lot of work on that Lyle mentioned on dictionaries and grammars. I've also been involved with workshops on grammar and transcription and doing linguistic work and so on. And I think I've also been, as Lyle mentioned, I was director of the Center for Aboriginal Initiatives at the University of Toronto, which I think was a group that had a tremendous impact on me in terms of how one goes about thinking of working with Aboriginal communities in Canada and what the role of the outsider is in working with such communities today. Okay, so that's me. Maya Chakabi is a Anishinaabemowin woman who some of you might have met actually at the last conference here because she gave a talk on the work that she's been doing. So Maya, and we'll talk about more as we do the program that she's been involved in, but she's one of those people who is deeply involved in notions of building communities and in having languages as one of the things that keeps communities together. And so when we talk about the Ojibwe language program, we'll hear a lot about her. The other three people, Maurice Nayeli, Deborah Simmons, and Doris Tanaton, are people involved in Delany, and maybe I'll save them and introduce them when we get to Delany, so you've got people lined up with where they are. Okay, so the first thing that we'll talk about is a program that's called GEMON. The C is a J or a CH. This is an Ojibwe word, or an Anishinaabemowin word that means canoe. I see nods from the Algonquians in the audience. It's a general Algonquian word, not just Ojibwe. And this is a program that Maya Chakabi and a group of people developed with each other that they call an Anishinaabemowin learning community. So Maya was studying Ojibwe at the University of Toronto, and she got deeply interested in what kind of methods one might use for language teaching that might be more effective than some of the ways that she had seen used. So we were able to get her a small grant so that she could go and visit the Ojibwe language instructors throughout the province of Ontario and find out what kinds of things they were doing so that she could go to an immersion camp and see what was going on there. Out of this, she developed the notion with a group of other people that what she would like to do was find ways of better learning the language, but that in order to do that, it wasn't going to happen just by going to school or sitting in a classroom and so on, but that what really needed to happen was to develop a community. And so the efforts that that group has made over recent years have been aimed at creating a learning community and to do that through the teaching, learning, and promotion of the language. The way they've done that is to develop transferable job skills. So these are things in leadership training, so how to facilitate groups, computer skills, programming skills, archiving skills, assisting elders, so the widest range of things that you could think of, which are really about communities. They're not skills about language, but they're general skills that people could use, applying them to language, but using them far, far beyond language, using them for communities. So by this program, I've got a lot of notes here that go beyond that, so let me just try to summarize some of them. So the idea is that what you do is you involve all generations from youth through to elders and working together to develop these communities. There's a core community and there's a broader community. This idea really captured the attention of the Aboriginal Employment Agencies in Toronto. And so this has been funded through the Aboriginal Employment Agency that's called Mizzouébeek, and it's also been funded through the Ontario-level Ministry of Training, Colleges, and Universities. The language alone, it wouldn't get that funding. This is being funded because what it's doing is developing these job skills. And the people that have worked through this program are in a variety of jobs now. Some of them are doing language teaching, but others of them are doing other things, both with community organizations and with various Aboriginal groups within the University of Toronto. And they continue to have their language community. This is only 3 or 4 years old. What's the future of it going to be? We don't have any idea, but what it's done is something kind of amazing in creating a group and in creating a different kind of materials. So they've taken on a lot of projects. The prime one has really been the job training, but there are a number of others that have served to bring a larger community together. So one of them is socials. So there have been a lot of socials that bring together people, learners of all ages from across the greater Toronto area, and it gets a turnout like this. There have been theater projects, there have been honoring ceremonies, and many other kinds of things. There's ongoing work with one of the, it's called Native Child and Family, with the workers there to bring the work into the daycares through that community development. So this is really a project in community development. So let's look at its contributions. What about the contribution of GMON to language conservation? Well, I think everybody, if I told you enough, would agree that there's a contribution to language conservation. That's where she started from, in one way, doing that through community building. So I think we can give that a check, that there's a big contribution to conservation. What about GMON and documentation? There was no interest in documentation when this started. Maya used to just think linguistics was for the birds. And she'd say, oh, there's this one person who's studying linguistics, and he's a real language learner, and I'll just ask him questions if I have them. But who cares about it? Now, she has produced a 100-page, single-spaced teaching grammar of the language, because what she found was that the materials, like Rand Valentine's work on Ojibwe, is amazing, but it doesn't come at it from the perspective that she wanted to come at it from. And so it's coming at it, trying to revision it through Aboriginal eyes, and it has lots of Rand's work in it, and it's got a lot more, because what they've found is that there's lots of stuff that wasn't there. There's most obviously probably vocabulary development. We live in downtown Toronto, so how do you have the vocabulary that's going to be relevant to downtown Toronto? But in addition to that, there's other structural kinds of things that aren't there. In addition to that, there's a kind of a creation of a language by trying to overcome some of the dialect things that are barriers to younger people, although they're not barriers to fluent speakers. And so working together to try to do that. So in fact, the documentation has come about in various ways. as far as linguistics again, what's so interesting to me is how she's come to see the value of linguistics. And this is my experience other places too, that a lot of times the linguistics isn't the leader, but as people work more and more, they begin to see that the linguistics can actually do them some good and then set out to get the training in it, but it's a follower rather than a leader. So GMON, and moving forward to return to our major theme, I think a lot of what makes this moving forward in my eyes is that it's coming from a community to meet their needs. They've felt that they needed to be a community and that language was one way of helping to make that into a community. They're kind of creating sort of like a local language cell. And this has done something kind of amazing for that group of people. And some of you have seen some of the materials, and I think the materials really come at it from a perspective that would have been impossible if it hadn't started with an idea that the community was the most important thing for the language learning. Okay, so that's one model. That's a sort of new model, a new community. The other one I want to talk about is a community of Delany, which is a community in northern Canada. So I probably could figure out how to point with this, but I'm not going to. If you look at the green dot near the top, the green circle, that's Athabascan languages in the Northwest Territories. The community we're going to look at is on Great Bear Lake, and it's just south of the Arctic Circle, and it's minus 25 Celsius there right now with lots of snow. This is a map of the official languages of the Northwest Territories. So what we're talking about is the blue circle, that's North Slavey, that's the name the government uses, and the community we're talking about is Delany. Okay. So we're going to be located for pretty much the rest of the time in that community. Okay, so let me introduce the people from Delany now. I had their names up before. I first worked with Delany in, the late 1970s, doing work there on the Slavey grammar. And I was also involved in training people in the community, working on a dictionary in that community, and just working on a variety of projects with people there. And the people who are involved in this are Morris Nayali, and I don't think he would call himself an elder, but he's kind of like an elder in that community. His primary interest is probably environment, and that's something he's been involved in the Delany Land Corporation for a long time. He comes from a very unusual family that is really a family that supported research in this community for probably 40 years. So research on a variety of topics, research on music in the community, research on various political issues in the community, and also a very deeply religious family, a very unusual person. The second person who's involved in this, who's from Delany, is Doris Tanaton. While Morris Nayali is at the elder's end, Doris is at the youth end of things. She's in her early 20s. She's a speaker of the language, although as most of you would probably realize, her speech and Morris's speech are very different from each other, as they're probably 30 years apart in age, and she speaks a speech of younger speakers. She's been involved with working with the youth, and she's done things like set up career days and be involved in radio projects and mapping projects and digitizing projects. Then the third person that's involved in this is Deborah Simmons. Deborah Simmons actually she's not from Delany, but her father worked in another community in the Northwest Territories when she was very young, and so she's had a lot of connections with the Northwest Territories. She has a PhD in political science, and she returned to the North after having been away for quite a few years in the late 1990s, and she's the person who's kind of the facilitator for what's called the Delaney Knowledge Project. And so that's the people that are involved. And we talked and talked and talked about all this, and they've looked at it, so I think this has their approval, even though I'm the one that's saying it. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the history of the community, because that's something that's important here to understand what's going on today and what moving forward means. So in some ways, most of these communities in the Northwest Territories are relatively recently formed. There was a history of the church in the communities from the middle part of the 19th century and the Hudson Bay trading posts, but people didn't really move into the communities to stay for any time period until around the 1950s when schooling became mandatory, and even then people didn't really move into the communities until maybe 30 or 40 years ago. So there have been a broad notion of community, but a community in terms of a settlement where people are most of the time is a pretty recent thing. This particular community of Delaney in the 1970s, when I first went to the Northwest Territories, was known as the community where people spoke Dene with their children. So it was sort of off the beaten track. People didn't go there as often. And it was, that was the way people talked about it in the other communities in the 1970s. Television was introduced there in maybe the 1990s. And now there are some people that are some of the elders that are pretty much monolingual Dene speakers who understand some English but are pretty monolingual Dene. And then there are children who are monolingual English, maybe understand some Dene, but pretty much monolingual English. So one of the things that we did in 2007 was a survey with 20 grade 10 to 12 students. And so this was a qualitative survey, and people were asked a variety of questions about their language use and their knowledge of the culture and so on. So this is in 2007. At that time, of these 20 students, 65% of them said they spoke the language as well as English, and 35% of them said they spoke only English, and their use of Dene was primarily in the home. If you look at the census figures, they show something a little bit different, but that's, you know, this is sort of an idea. So it's important to understand that here's a community where language is used. So the children are not speaking the language, but there is language in the community. You can go to the store and you can hear people speaking the language. So I do think it's important to keep that in mind, because this particular model might not work in a language, in a community where there was no language being spoken. Okay. I'm just going to name a few activities that have gone on in recent years. So this is in about the past 10 or 12 years. There's lots more, and I just pulled out a few. Okay, people from Delaney worked at Port Radium, which is another community on Great Bear Lake, before World War II. At some point around 10 or 12 years ago, people in the community became aware that it was their families that had done the mining of the uranium that was used to drop the bombs on Japan. And this really caused people to look inward and to want to try to understand what role they had played. There was also a very high incidence of cancer in the community, and so there was a concern over that. So the Delaney Uranium Team looked at the time that people had been involved in uranium mining from a whole variety of perspectives. So there were perspectives on what had this done to the land, there were perspectives on what had it done to the water, what had it done to the animals, so a lot of ecological perspectives. And then another perspective was what had it done to the people. Well, to understand that, what did that mean? That meant talking to people who had lived there, who had grown up there. one of the results of that is a book of stories in the Dene language that that came out of that. Other results of that were mapping projects, learning how to do GIS. Here's something that the community wanted to know. In order to understand this, you had to use the language. There was no other way of doing it than using the language. I already mentioned that Dene K'day survey report. That was just a little thing, but the idea behind that was, let's understand our landscape in order to understand what's going on with it in this community and what kinds of things might be thought about if we're thinking about language. One of the things that came out of that is that the students that they interviewed felt like they didn't really have much of an understanding of Dene culture and Dene history. The next two or three, climate change, health, environment, have been big issues. Last year or the year before, there was a polar bear in Delaney, which is a kind of an unheard thing, partly due to climate change, not totally, but partly. Health issues due to climate change, environmental issues due to climate change. People are deeply interested in these. The issue that I'm going to talk most about is self-governance, and Ingeborg Fink is here representing a group from Delaney, and there's a poster about this. So if you want to know more about this than I'm going to say, she's the person to talk to about it. So there had in most parts of Canada, there had been treaties signed, but there were no treaties signed in the Northwest Territories. So in 1996, the community of Delaney began to negotiate for self-government. And in 2003, an agreement in principle was signed that there should be self-government. Okay, it's easy to say that there's self-government. What self-government is a tremendously complex issue. And so since 2003, between 2003 and 2009, a lot of energy was put into trying to understand what self-government meant. And finally in 2009, there was somebody hired to be in charge of implementing self-government. So this has been gone about in various ways, and so one way has been to really think hard about what government means and to work with English terminology and translate it into Dene. But there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that on the part of particularly of elders, but also with people that have been deeply involved in government. And so the current notion is that the way of understanding what self-government should mean is something that should come by understanding what this broadest notion of governance has meant to people in the past and how that notion of governance can be translated into understanding what the government should be for the future. So what are the things that underlie government? What is a Dene vision of health and what it means to be healthy, because that means different things in different cultures. What is the Dene notion of education and what does it mean to be a well-educated person within this community? I could go on, but I think I've said enough so that you have the idea. So coming out of this notion of self-governance, which really issues of health and environment fall under, is to use stories. Okay, who do you need stories from? Well, it's the elders who have the stories, but who needs to hear the stories? It's the youth who needs to hear the stories. And so this project involves bringing together people from the community as a whole, the youth, the elders, and in between, to listen to the stories, to talk about the stories, to interpret the stories, to understand what they mean. The stories are all in the Dene language. The youth are interviewing people. It's hard for them often to do that, but they're doing what they can with their language. So that this is an environment where language is being used to understand things that are driving this community at the moment, and they can't do it without the language. there's lots of other work, and I just don't want to talk too much longer, so I won't say too much, but there's been a focus on things like prayers, on things like place names, on things like mapping. Some of the most interesting work that's gone on in this community has been radio work, with working with students in the schools to produce radio documentaries. And there's one that, if you're interested in looking it up, it's on the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company website, that's called Waterheart, which is about Great Bear Lake. And there was a whole unit about the history of the lake, and this radio documentary, basically in Dene, resulted from that. Okay, so let me return. Okay, let me just answer these questions first. Okay, Delaney and documentation. Well, I think from what I've said, I hope it's obvious how much documentation is going on. It's at the heart of understanding where people come from, that they're trying to collect the stories and have conversations about the past, and all of this is being recorded. I might say that not everybody is keen on the recording. There are strong feelings about it both ways, about the recording, because of that age-old sense that putting things down preserves them rather than keeps them alive. So while we view writing it down as keeping it alive, not everybody views writing it down as keeping it alive. Many people view writing it down as somehow freezing it at a point in time. What about Delaney and language conservation? Well, if you went into the school, you might think not much was going on. There's been Dene language taught in the schools for a long time. But if you go into the community, I think you'd have to say that here's a kind of conservation that you kind of wish you could see everywhere, in that these various activities that are going on are leading to people being interested in using the language, but they're not growing out of the education programs really. It's really growing out of the community programs rather than the school programs that this is happening. Delaney and linguistics. Well, I think that on my part, there was a lot of time that I was just sort of, people knew I was there and was happy to do what needed to be done, but I wasn't ready to do it when people weren't all that interested in it. But I think that this community has really made really good use of linguists. So I talked about the training I've done, and I'm sorry, I meant to mention earlier Sally Rice, who's here. We're not related to each other, despite the same name, who will talk about the CILDI, Canadian Indigenous Language and Literature Documentation Institute, that has done training of quite a few of the people from Delaney, and so they've had great training from there. I've done a lot of training in the community, and there's been huge amounts of training in other areas. So, for instance, in GIS, there's been training in how to do good recordings, there's been training. How to work with people, there's been training. So there's been huge amounts of training going on. But linguistics is one piece of this. And Ingeborg Fink, who I mentioned earlier, was actually specifically invited to come to this community as a linguist for the kinds of things that she would be able to contribute and for the kind of linguistic analysis that she'll be able to bring that'll be helpful in keeping these programs alive and going. So Delaney and moving forward, well, to me in this community, it started from taking what is this community all about and what are the things that this community is really interested in. And so language is a critical piece of this, but it's not the first piece. The community is the first piece. The theme that reverberates through what I'm saying is that this is really about communities. More than it's about languages in a narrow sense, it's about communities. From these communities, I can't tell you how much really exciting linguistic work there is that can be done. It's just amazing the amount of stuff that could be done, but it's growing in a different way. So I've kind of talked about a model that takes language as piece of the larger social and political setting. And I hope I make clear that this isn't a model that can work everywhere. I'm really fortunate to be involved in these communities where this kind of model is one that's appropriate. But much of this kind of model really depends on so many factors, and I mentioned some of them, and I'll repeat them: the capacity of the community, the health of the community, the history of that community, leadership roles, sustainability, and relationships, which is a word we can never forget because it's one of the most important words to use. So here we find that we're bringing together lots of different things, and we've learned so much about things that I never thought I would know very much about from being involved in this kind of model. I think in linguistics right now, we're kind of in a point where things are coming together. We sometimes talk about historical linguistics and genetic relationships as lumpers and splitters, so put all the languages together or put them each in their own group. And I think we've been through a period in linguistics where we've been more splitters, and there's been a value to that of understanding deeply certain things. I think we're in a time period now where we could use the word lumpers, where we're trying to come together and talk to each other, and it's an exciting time period to be part of. So let me just finish up. So these models are intergenerational. They're community-led. Training is critical in them, training going both ways, and language in use, not language as something that's frozen in a classroom, but language that's being used in a community and working with language as it's been being used. And I think I said all that, so I won't repeat it. So let me just end. I hope that whoever you are here, whether you're a linguist engaged in language documentation and conservation or thinking about it, whether you're a community member, I hope I've given you some food for thought about some of the many kinds of considerations there can be and one of the many ways that there might be of moving forward when a community is in a situation that it allows for something like this. I also hope that we can pay attention to the titles of two things. One is the grant that's called The Words of Our Ancestors, Our Paths to the Future. So understanding the past in order to understand the future and how much difference that history makes in what a community is going to be able to do. And as was said before, that we want to work together to go the right way, and figuring out what that right way is very important. So let me say thank you in two languages to you: Masi, which is the Dene word, and Miigwech, which is the Ojibwe word. And I hope that this might have gotten you off to a good start for what promised to be a really exciting few days. Thank you. Okay, Lyle says I should take questions, my own questions. So if anybody has questions, I'm happy to try. I think there's microphones, I think, for questions.